Hi everyone, my name is Yarrow and you're listening to the Creative Nature Podcast. I'm coming to you with a beautiful, beautiful interview I did with Melissa Ward just this week, and I'm able to share it now because I no longer have this huge backlog of interviews. I paused recording new ones for a while in the winter and now we're up to speed, so that's cool. Anyway, I'll tell you, Melissa is amazing. She's an artist and a dancer and a somatic facilitator, and we covered so much really inspiring ground. I was in her program around grief threats, and it really shifted my perspective of what I can do with my grief and what it might teach me. So I hope that you'll love this interview as much as I did, and that you'll check Melissa's work out, maybe even join her newsletter. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. I don't have any other updates today, but I'm sending lots of love to you. Bye. Hello, everyone. I am greeting you with giggles because I'm having the most delightful guest with me. I'm talking to Melissa Ward, who is an artist and a dancer and a writer and so many other things. And I know her because I think it was last year, but I lost track of time in really big ways. Anyway, I was in the Grief Threats program, which was so beautiful. We made these little pieces of textile art, and it really provided the most gorgeous little vessel for my grief, of which there is a lot about the world and the things. And it really made me think about art making in a new way that I hadn't done before. It was so beautiful. And I still think about some of the things that we talked about in the group, like the stars that were long. Maybe we'll get to that. But anyway, I also worked with Melissa last month, receiving some mentoring in my own art practice. And it was so, so affirming and beautiful. I really felt like more new exciting things were coming through, and so I'm so happy to have you here. Thank you so much for talking to me. Thank you so much for being in the world and choosing colors. We were just talking about Pop-Tarts and how wild they are. So yeah, thank you so much. I'm really excited to talk to you, and would love to hand it over to you. Let us know who you are, where you are, what you do.
Thank you so much for having me. It is such a gift to be in your very giggle-friendly, giggle-fest container this morning. So currently I am sitting in Atlanta, Georgia, in the United States. You named me as a dancer and a writer and creator of workshops. I feel like my work right now is as a movement-specific artist, really helping people find ways back into their body, finding creative ways to develop a deeper relationship to the body. And therefore, that tends to be like a natural secret door into this incredibly rich creative life that everyone has. But there's so many reasons and ways people feel like they don't have access to it. So that is what my world has looked like currently. That's how you and I found each other. You referenced grief threads, which, continues. I, too, think about things that have been shared in that class and in that workshop. As, it's a space, it's a small cohort for people to come together. Can you hear my sweetheart opening up a coconut in the background?
I wish I could. I cannot.
Wow. Okay, dear listeners, just to paint the little insert picture, my sweetheart is in the kitchen behind me with a like machete like utensil banging into a coconut, and probably has his noise canceling headphones on, so he doesn't know. We found each other through Grief Threads and just are totally obsessed with each other ever since, and keep finding ways to talk to each other and work with each other on the internet. Kind of lost my train of thought, so I'll toss it back to you.
That's cool. There are so many different threads I would love to pick up here, but I think one that really speaks to me right now is talking a little bit about what lockdown has been like for you. I know that's maybe not the most glamorous question, but I can really see that your work has, you know, been reshaped, been reimagined, been probably deeply affected by grief and change and uncertainty. And I think you are someone who, I just love how you articulate those things. And I don't even, you know, I'm on your newsletter. I highly recommend it to people if you're curious. It's so good. I really love it. And I just always love how you talk about the way things are. And I wonder if you have more to say about how the pandemic has shaped your work and your life so far.
I really, in some ways, this is like, it's still hard for me to broadcast this out loud, although I'm going to say it because I think many people can relate. And I've already heard a lot of people kind of come out and say this sort of controversial thing, which is like, yes, the pandemic was so devastating in so many ways. And yet I was able to find an immense gift inside of it, which was this incredible spaciousness. It like changed my life for the better in many, many ways. And I recognize that as like all kinds of intersecting privileges and just the way that like my life had been conducted and my lifestyle. It was very easy for me to like shelter in place. I happened to really like the people that I was living in a house with. And so it felt like a place, it felt like time beneath time where like I found this, like, again, I referenced this earlier, like a secret door that was like, oh, a refuge from business as usual. And so, yeah, and through the job that I had at the time, I was able to be financially supported, but also just like really fall off the map of having to exist in all of the ways I had existed before. And so my art practice, it was like my art practice thrived in a lot of ways, but in a very 12th housey kind of way for folks who are planetarily interested and paying attention to that stuff. It was like, oh, this like psychic inner world just like unfolded and kept unfolding. And I just felt like I was, you know, at first, like it felt like terrifying, like I was falling forever, but I just kept like, I don't know, like swimming in this darkness that was like, kept getting richer and richer. And I was falling more into myself and more in love with what I was finding. But I also just really kind of went off the map in terms of anything I produced, anything I shared. And prior to that, I was, I guess my capital C career as an artist was as a dance maker and a choreographer. And so I was like reasonably prolific in terms of like always in a process of working with dancers or working with myself and producing performance content and producing like these big shows out in the world. And I just, you know, stopped doing that and was like, oh, am I a dancer anymore? Am I a producer of live art anymore? I kept thinking about like the idea of like if a tree falls in the woods and no one is there to hear it, like if a dancer isn't making dances, if nobody sees the dancer dancing, are they a dancer anymore? So yeah, but I feel like to really answer your question, I think what has been so magical for me on the other side, having some space, is that it helped me like pivot my North Star. Most definitely more towards service. And so then I've been able to see how all of my training and experience has like a modern dancer, a professional dance maker, an embodied person of like, oh, actually these experiences maybe are better served as like experiences for other people that I can create and make for other people. I can make rooms, I can make workshops, I can make experiences for other people who don't feel creative, who don't feel connected to their body, into that like essential life force of inspiration. They might better serve the world as opposed to like, hello world, look at me dancing. Look at this dance I made. Come to my show. So that was the big pivot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that so much. And I totally know what you mean. I think there's so much that you have to offer to people that's coming out of dance practice, I imagine. I, like I said, absolutely loved Grief Threads. And yeah, maybe you can say a little bit more. I've always loved so much how you shared about improvisation. I remember in the Grief Threads thing, you asked us to play with fabric in this really new way. And there was a part of me that was like, what do you mean? I thought we're making a quilt. And this is playing. Is that allowed? Yeah, please.
I love that so much. Right. It's like playing is so natural to us as children, right? Like children need no prompts, no invitations, no directives on, like, they just see like really ordinary crap laying around and they're like, I invented a new game. Look how much fun I'm having. I'm playing with the most ordinary things. And then, of course, as we know, that gets stripped from us pretty early on. But what I think is fun is kind of like also, you know, you and I have talked separately about like this act of reparenting the inner child, right? And I think the like there's some kind of like punchline or the like the universal joke is that when we choose to reparent the child in us who knows how to play so intrinsically, there is so much there's actually so much information underneath that. Like not only is it really like, oh great, it's fun to remember how to play, that's awesome. But secondarily, or maybe more importantly, is like when we return to remembering how to play as adults, it's like, oh wow, there's actual intelligence and wisdom for me inside the fun that we're having. And so like and to give an example, a more concrete example of like in Grief Threads, which is a workshop to explore one's grief, however you define that, right? Because there's such an expansive spectrum of grief that we are all holding and carrying. But the invitation of Grief Threads, an online workshop, is to bring the fabrics that you have in your life that are somehow related to a grief experience. You bring them to class, you kind of kindergarten style show and tell those fabrics, you tell us whatever is interesting to you about them. And then we do these kind of somatic based, I guess is what I call them. We play, we improvise with them in these kind of maybe unexpected or unconventional ways, as you mentioned. And then we cut them up, tear them up, rip them up, and we sit with the ungodly swell of emotions that may come up when you tear, rip, destroy these things. And we sit with that, we play with that. And then eventually we learn how to piece, patchwork, repair these scraps of yourself, these scraps of your life, into new configurations and new constellations. And you come out of class with this like incredibly gorgeous, even if you have no idea what you're doing, you've never picked up a needle and thread. Everybody comes out with this like insanely gorgeous patchwork, and that is like evidence of so much repair that happens in class. But in the playing with the fabric, it's like, okay, there will be an instruction to like, you've got, say, like a sweater, a sundress, some socks, and this like dish towel that you used to like cry into when you learned your grandmother first died, right? That's what you come to class with. And you, one of the games is we like lay them all out, and then I invite folks to create like a little mini landscape. And we just like put on a a little jam, a little song. I'm going to take like 5 minutes. This is so low stakes. You just like jumble this pile of fabrics around to create some kind of contoured landscape. Playing, right? No agenda. Just get in there. And then most likely, as you said, people are like, wait, what? Like, you want me to do what? And then you get into it and you just do it. And then we like have this moment where we play tour guides with each other. And we like imagine this is an actual landscape. And then we kind of describe like, okay, well, who lives here? What is here? What kind of environment is in like swirling around this? Is this like an alien landscape with no oxygen? Are there inhabitants? Do things grow here? We just, you know, kind of like use our imaginations for a few minutes and tell these improvised stories. And then it's like people are like, oh, wow, did I just say, like, oh, in saying that, there's this like secret information that comes forth from the subconscious. And it maybe is kind of like a puzzle piece for you, the person who created it, or maybe it's a puzzle piece that helps somebody else think about their grief differently. And so in the playing and in the improvising and in the sharing, I have found that it's actually the people in the room that are the keys for each other. Like someone will say something and it's like, oh, yeah, I needed to hear that.
Yeah, that felt definitely true for me. I loved it so much. I loved noticing my resistance in the beginning to just playing and then the permission and how fun it was in the end and really how it helped me to relate to some pieces of grief so differently and just to be together as well. I think that in itself was so magical to be in a room with people who also wanted to work with their grief creatively. I mean, like, what a gift, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? Like, I was talking to a dear friend of mine earlier this morning, and he took the very first round of grief threads. And I remember this thing he says all the time. He mentioned it in the class where it's like a Tom Waits lyric or something that he said in an interview maybe, which is every song needs an address. But in grief threads in the class, he referenced that to say, like, grief needs an address. Grief needs a place that we can pour ourselves, pour the pain, pour the intense emotional charge. We need a place to pour it into, which also makes me think so much about what you and I talked about in our month-long container of desire needs a container. You know, like some of these things that we have to walk with are just so big and bigger than our bodies, bigger than our brains can contain. And so it's so helpful to use our creative birthright to make something outside of ourselves that becomes that container, becomes that address that we can pour anything into.
Yeah, so true. And I love how you're bringing the body in as well. And I also love, for people who can't see, my dog is having a moment of
responding. It's really sweet.
He's kind of trying to merge into me because we've been apart today. So I've been holding it for like a solid 10 minutes and he's still, every time I turn away a bit, he's like, no.
It's truly, it's really like, I'm getting like it's like secondhand smoke. I'm getting some, secondhand, like deep pet support and sturdiness right now.
He is a triple earth sign, which it makes a lot of sense. That's exactly what I needed. Anyway, I'm wondering if you would be happy to talk a little bit more about how the body comes into all these things for you, because you have such a lovely way of holding your classes in a way that's really engaging and intellectually fun, but it doesn't abandon the body, right? I would love to come to an in-person class whenever I see you share them. I'm so jealous that it's not down the road for me. I would also love to time travel and do one of your workshops for teenagers. So please tell a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So, where do I want to start with this? In my early 20s, like while I was in college and coming out of college, my job was teaching dance classes, largely teaching like sweet little elementary school babies ballet, because it paid really well, right? People pay lots of money to put their sweet little children in tutus and pink tights. And oh man, that is that's God's work right there. That's that is so wild. I did it because I knew how to do it, but I just always felt like, wow, this is such a betrayal to be teaching these young children how to contort their bodies in these like totally insane, rigid ways, and instilling these like old kind of militant structures in the body. It was like such a microcosm of indoctrinating young people into systems and structures that are thoroughly oppressive to your humanity. And so I was like, never again. I'm done. I shall not teach dance because I don't know how to not perpetuate these rules and rigid, even in like, more free movement and like modern dance classes, but there's still just these structures and rules baked in that are really detrimental to the body and the felt experience of the body, because you're trying to achieve a certain look rather than trying to really, really get super sensitive with how your body feels. Because if you are really sensitive with how your body feels, you might not show up to class. You might be in bed still. You might be face down on the floor in a little puddle pile. I abandoned teaching dance for a really long time. But then I think it was a grief. If you're referencing the crybaby dance classes that I now teach, okay, yes. That actually came out of grief threads. It was one cohort in particular where last year that happened to have quite a few local Atlanta-based people in it, even though we were virtual, and we were all sitting around and we were sharing. It was like in a very, talk heavy particular class. And I was like, okay, it's great. This is beautiful, but we're going to stop what we're doing right now. We're all going to stand up. I'm going to put on Fela Kuti for 10 minutes and we're going to shake our asses vigorously, vigorously, right? I want you to feel just every cell of your body like flinging through the air. I want you to feel your skin, your fat, your hair, your juices just wobbling. And then we'll come back and see what we want to talk about. And we did that. And everybody came back and they were like, holy shit, I feel like a different person. This is so great. Can we have a grief dance class all of the time? Oh, teaching dance class. Uh-oh, here we go. But it just felt so correct, right? Like, we know this. You are such a body person, such a somatic practitioner. Like, you know that like silly little phrase, the issues be living in the tissues. So we have to have ways, in my personal philosophy, we have to have ways that are like movement spaces that aren't related to making your body do anything it doesn't want to do. Right, it's not a workout class, not a fitness class, but it's a little bit more shaped and guided than just like going to the club, which is such a cathartic space. Currently in person experience called Crybaby Dance Club exists. It's a weekly dance class. I have a DJ. I have disco balls. We are in this like really funny like 70s rec center, community center. In the like gym, what we call a gymnatorium. It's like used to be a gym, but also kind of an auditorium where it has this really cute old stage. Yeah, and we think about what it means to process emotional complexity through dance, through movement, through coming together, and finding joy through felt experience. It's been great, but I definitely want to make it. I am in the process right now. Listeners, stay tuned. I think there is a really cool version that exists on the internet for this as like a monthly dance party that's, you know, so is guided, but also is very much helping people to play and improvise and create their own like solo movement practice for emotional stuff.
That is so needed and makes me so happy there might be an online version. That's amazing news. You touched a little bit on creating your own practice and also on reparenting. And I want to share at this point, my reparenting strategy at the moment is having my daily pancakes. I'm coming up to a year now of having pancake for myself every single day. Since you're asking, I'm going to tell you more about them.
Yes, please.
So wonderful.
Vigorous head nod.
Cinnamon and almonds. And then I add a layer of coconut yogurt and then hot berries that used to be in the freezer. I always get these big, huge bags of frozen berries and I heat them up and then on top, and then the whole thing is steaming and it's just so wonderful. But anyway, please tell me more about your reparenting. How are you looking after yourself as a facilitator? As someone, you know, also experiencing grief, what does your own practice look like at the moment? I always imagine dancers begin their day with just something really fancy, but
oh my god, say more. Like what? Like a decadent cappuccino and biscotti.
Yes, definitely, but also probably wearing some glitter, dancing in the shower already, definitely singing. Bouncing to the door when the mail person comes.
Okay, taking notes. This is all about to be my new practice. Thank you so much.
But please tell me more about the real deal.
The real deal. Okay, first of all, before I do that, I just have to say, dear listeners, I have had the immense privilege to receive some photo documentation of some of these re-parenting pancakes. And it's so swoon worthy. Like you can feel how charged these pancakes are when you see a photo of them. I'm not even seeing the hot steaming plate in real life. I'm seeing just a picture, but they're just so beautiful. And you can just feel how much like love, care, and self-respect is like literally baked into these pancakes, and I just want to eat them so bad. They look amazing. They look like superhuman or superhero. That's the word. Like superhero fuel. That's what they seem like. So I just hope for everyone somehow that you have a chance to see Euro's magic pancakes somehow. Oh my gosh, maybe there's like a. Do you make like a secret Tumblr where you like post a picture every day and it's like Aww. People can go and just like get a secondhand hit of reparenting
magic? That
would be magic.
So cute. I love Tumblr. It's funny you say that. I really want to bring Tumblr back in so many ways.
Yes.
I have not posted. I do send a picture of my pancake to a small group of my closest friends every single day. Just, you know, for reference. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about making them into zines someday. So, you know, these picture walls where like a portrait or a picture of something else is made of like thousands of tiny pieces.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That could totally be happening with pancakes because I have all these hundreds on my phone. That could be cool.
Oh my God, my mouth is so agape right now. This is incredible. I can't wait to see that. I want that to be just like a portrait of your face, like shining. Like that's the ultimate big picture it makes. It's just this like glowing, huge, toothy smile.
That would be doable because my face is often so pink. I'm like very like, yeah, just a lot of blood flowing to my face. But anyway, I think the last thing I'll say about this practice is I love it so much because of what it symbolizes. I think as a kid and as a teenager growing up, I always imagined that if you had a really stable middle-class family and like a real home where people, anyway, so like just a beautiful, super stable home, then your parents would make you the same breakfast every day and you would always wake up and feel like so secure because you know there'll be the pancake. But it's never too late. You can give yourself the pancake.
You really, really can.
Yeah.
Wow. Food for thought. Food for thought, y'all. Well, you were asking about what my rituals for reparenting. I think probably the height of having really concentrated reparenting rituals like really happened in that like 2020 kind of time beneath time container for me. But I will say, you referenced dancing in the shower. That is something I do. Like I actually did it this morning because I was feeling sort of cuckoo when I woke up. And I have like a handful of things, my little strategies, my little tools for when I feel cuckoo. One of them, and it usually involves, you know, movement of some sort, right? Like going on a walk. It's a really kind of low hanging fruit version for some of us. I'm very lucky to live in a place where it's like so dense with trees and there's all these like beautiful little neighborhoods that I can access very easily on foot from where I live. But being in the shower and yeah, like just feeling my spine as this incredible highway of nerves, this like sensuous snake-like creature that can like loop and move and wind and wiggle as I feel like hot water rolling over me is just such an incredible reset. Moving my voice too feels like such a way to clear the channel. And I think with like for reparenting myself, so much of what, I mean, I think many of us can relate to this. Most of us can relate to this. It's like reparenting for me is so much about safety and like just not feeling safe in my body. So thinking about the ways that I can really like establish that safety, which to be honest, in this moment, the thing that comes to mind is like, for me, what I think it really looks like, although I haven't described this, I haven't described this as a reparenting moment until maybe now, but it's just to remind myself throughout the day that I alone create my sense of safety and I can do it right now, right now, right now. Literally, no matter what the circumstance or the environment that I find myself in, it's, and I do think of it, I referenced the spine in the showers, like I do feel like it's a sturdying of the spine. And when I think about my backside, it's like, oh yeah, I have my own back, but then I feel what that actually feels like, right? Like I can say like, yeah, boo, I got you. Like I've got my own back. I'm on my own side. I've got my back. But to move that from just like a brain platitude into like, okay, then I feel my spine and I feel like the sturdiness of it. And I feel it like almost like compacted with like clay. Such a weird image, but like I see it as like with my own hands inside my body, like putting clay, like warm, wet, like Georgia red clay around my spine as this like act of sturdying it. Never said that sentence out loud. I hope that makes sense. But I think, yeah, visual cues like that are very helpful for creating that like inner sense of safety.
Yes, that's so true. It feels so soothing just to hear that, you know, having one's own back, creating one's own sense of safety. And I think in a weirdly twisted way, the deep confrontation and intimacy with grief has something that has really added to that for me. Because I don't know, like a lot of people will find what I'm about to say, like really not comforting at all, maybe even horrifying. I don't know. But I feel like I've become so intimate with death that the pandemic has offered so many moments where I was like just really drowning in anxiety and not having the usual distractions or the usual ways of working through that, especially being, you know, being isolated. I think your anxiety just amplifies so much because it bounces, you know, in this echo chamber of your own mind without other people to co-regulate with. And so I think the only way is through, because we didn't know how long it would be, that we didn't know when the light at the end of the tunnel would come initially. And so I think like the only way through was kind of being like, okay, like, if I unpack what I'm really afraid of, at the end of the day, it's always death, right? Like most things can be broken down to, you just won't want to die. Like it's fun to be alive. Why would you? Sure. And there's something so beautifully humbling in that, I think, when we just keep asking, like, you know, what is it that I'm really afraid of? And I think when we say we're creating our own sense of safety, of course, you can hold both and also recognize that like there's things that are out of our control and there's nothing really you can do about them. But yeah, for some reason, for me, it's been really comforting to be like, well, you know, what is the fear of losing my home really about? It's really about losing a good sense of groundedness and belonging and physical shelter. And that's ultimately about staying alive. And what if I can just accept that wanting to stay alive and fearing death in some way is part of my human experience and be alongside that a little bit and make pancakes every morning. So just feeling more
successful. More importantly, morning pancakes.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that is such an important thing that you're naming, because I think that really sort of like the gloves came off in a lot of ways for revealing how death phobic we are. I think, I don't want to say globally, because it definitely feels, I'll speak from the culture from which I come, the dominant overculture of America is extraordinarily death phobic. And yet I find is a place that really perpetuates death and dying in a lot of ways. It's among many things, right? Places and nations are much complicated concepts, but I found that it really became during the pandemic just such a like a rallying cry, that's the phrase that comes to mind, of like, oh yeah, like we, like there's so much that needs our attention that is in a process of death and decay, and we're really harming ourselves if we keep turning away from it and vilifying it, because again, there's like secret information, there's secret wisdom underneath it. It makes me think of the Greek myth of the three-headed dog that's guarding hell? I might be just like mishmashing culture here.
Maybe that's true. I do know of a three-headed dog. Tell me more.
Am I thinking of Harry Potter, y'all? Okay, hold on. I might be thinking of Harry Potter. What is like the three-headed dog that is guarding the you know, it's like the Philosopher's Stone, this like secret chamber underneath Hogwarts. Okay, we're pulling on a lot of mythic threads here. But yeah, it's like there's this ferocious three-headed dog that feels like our relationship to death and dying. And it's like, oh my God, all you would want to do is run from the dog. Like, don't confront the dog. That's just sounds like horrific. But you have already named and outed yourself as someone who has like really like been up close and personal with a three-headed dog and found a way to soothe and subdue the ferocity of the dog. And then it turns out there's a trap door underneath the dog. It's like, wow, there's a magic, mysterious, like cave of wonders down there that, I think, a lot of societal ills could be healed and eradicated, if there was a much bigger, larger cultural willingness to, be in reverence of the three-headed dog, be, like in devotion to death, dying, decay, our grief, holding our own grief, holding the grief of others. It saddens me to say this, maybe it's neutral, maybe it's sad, but I think it will only increase. You know, I think we will only continue, like the more we push it away, the more we're going to have reasons to look at our grief and look at, you know, what is being lost on the planet. And I don't know, maybe that's really, I don't know, that is a kind of foreboding thing to say, but I mean, if you listen to the news, it's just like, woo, baby, okay, lots of stuff to feel some deep feelings about.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I so appreciate spaces like Grief Threads to practice and experiment and become a little bit more comfortable. And I think we can start practicing with really small losses and see what it feels to not turn away from them. And it really is like a muscle. If you've accepted one loss or one grief and you've been with it, and then the next wave comes, you're like, oh wow, yeah, I've done this before. I can probably do it again. And most importantly, it can coexist with so much joy and pleasure.
Yeah. Because
you're not subduing, you know, any of your feelings anymore. You're just feeling all of it and both of it. And that's so cool. I'm also trying to remind myself that, you know, I think our generation, I will go to this. I was like trying to rein the waffle in. Wait. You know, of course, we always say we want so much revolution, we want so much social change. But I think in this like denying of death, we're often forgetting that that would require such structural death of so much of what we've known our whole life. And if we're not practicing in our own private little world, you know, like what is the loss of a friendship? What is the loss of a job? If we can't do that, how can we expect that we could move through such fundamental societal change that we really want?
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's, I think it's Martine Prechtel who talks. He's just like such a beautiful and prolific writer about so much of the deep soul medicine, grief included. And he talks about how grief and praise, he doesn't use joy, but the word praise, grief and praise are like lovers. They're like bedfellows. They share an apartment. It's a quote about like they share space. And the idea that like you can only, the degree that you can experience joy, praise, effervescence, like immense ecstatic vitality, the degree that you can experience that is reciprocally related to the degree in which you can allow yourself to feel like the deep pit of your own despair. And for a lot of us, it's like that. I mean, it maybe feels like sort of wild and insane to be able to experience those super high peaks and those super low valleys. But yeah, that's like the gift gift of the experience of being a human, right? As opposed to this sort of just like flatline barge, like running in the middle where you're like, kind of don't feel that high, kind of don't feel that low, kind of maybe don't feel anything. And I think there is just this like proclivity towards numbness and numbing out and going on the barge, the middle way barge, which, hey, I'm not here to knock that experience for anybody, but I find myself more surfing the high peaks and the low valleys.
Me too. Wow, I could talk to you forever, and I can't believe that we've come to the hour almost, which has felt like 5 minutes. Wow. I would love to talk to you again if you would be up for being a guest again. But I want to, you know, respect your time and the listeners' time. So I would love to just ask you before we go what you're currently offering, what's coming up, and where people can find you, and how can they get your newsletter because they need it.
Oh, bless you. Bless you. Bless you. So I have a weekly newsletter. LOL. It's on Substack currently. I am renegotiating my relationship with Substack, but you can find on my website, which is my name, melissaword.com. I'm sure it'll be in the show notes somewhere, a little button to press. All of my stuff lives on that site, which includes signing up for my weekly newsletter on being more creatively involved in your life and in the world. And then depending on when this comes out, it might still be happening, but I'm in the process of, I just launched it earlier this week, and it is starting June 4th. It is a 3-week container for grief and creative practice. I'm describing it as like the cool younger sibling, like mysterious sibling of Grief Threads, that is a more expansive approach to making in general. So it's writing and drawing practices, sewing, textile, ripping things up, kind of Grief Threads adjacent practices, and then movement and the voice. So each week of the 3-week portal is a different making theme. But yeah, it's all about the stuff we've been talking about. So I think that will continue to exist in the future. But there's signups and information and all of the things one might need on my website, also on Instagram.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I'll definitely link to that. I highly recommend people check it out. I so appreciate what you've shared, Melissa. This was beautiful. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're the best. Thank you. My pleasure.